This is the FSM Podcast on the Fantasy Sports Markets Network. Here's Ben Heisler and Jeff Passan.
I think I have a slight corneal abrasion.
How did that happen?
I don't know. I got one a couple years ago, and it happened during the playoffs. And I have a picture of myself somewhere that I will send you, and it looks like the...
Like Costas pink eye, like
it was very much Costas during the Olympics. It looks like I have some kind of infectious disease in my eye, and I'm pretty sure it was just from a piece of dust. I must have fragile corneas, because last night it's not like I was trying to like power bomb my kid and he just stuck his finger up and just like gave me a wrestling heel poke right to the eye, like a Ric Flair shot to the eye. I was just sitting there doing my all prospect team for the year, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's something in my eye. It must be an eyelash. And then when you like throw water in it and put eye drops in it and it doesn't go away, you're like,
all right, this is a problem.
Yeah, so I'm trying to wait it out and hope that it goes away.
Did drops help at all? Like, can you use Visine or anything like that?
I have not used any drops. I've tried to flush it out with saline, but then I looked at the side of my saline and it had an expiration date of 2013. so I felt like using 5-year-old saline to wash out my eye probably not the most optimal way to go about things.
That's hysterical. Because nobody ever throws out Visine. Like, I wear contacts every so often, mostly to just work out or if I know I'm going to be outside for a while so I can wear sunglasses.
Sure. Yeah.
But, I mean, I use daily contacts, so I think the saline...
Do you really use daily contacts?
They're the best.
What do you think of daily contacts?
I will never go back to the 2-week variety, ever.
I don't know, man. Here's the thing. I think I have, like, 2-week contacts, but I tend to wear them for 3 months.
Okay, I think we've discovered where you got your corneal. Open and shut case, Johnson.
This podcast does more to expose my ridiculousness than just about anything. Like, you and my children are like the two checks of the two checks and balances that I have.
That's, I mean, first of all, that's terrifying. Second of all, I didn't know that it's come to this.
It always comes to this, Ben.
Yeah, go the daily route and you're going to be a much happier person.
All right. I keep hearing from my optometrist is a good friend of Sam Mellinger's.
Oh, okay.
After what he did last week, I just don't know if I can go see him anymore.
You can blame him for your corneal abrasion. And listen, we need to talk about this because you told me earlier today that you're still upset that I sided with Sam last week.
I'm particularly upset. Like the golf thing. Okay, I get it. I get that. But siding with him about kicking off the shoes. Which you knowing Sam Mel, like if this is like a Judge Judy situation where you don't know either of the litigants, then yeah, maybe you could see. You know Sam Mellinger though, and you know his tone of voice when he's telling the truth and when he's lying. And you bought into this false narrative that the shoes just happened to come off. He actively kicked them.
How can I prove it, though? If I'm supposed to be the judge, how can I prove other than tone of voice? Which, I know Sam, but I know you better. We have more of a relationship over the last, you know, several years.
Right.
So I, in theory, maybe...
Hold on. Okay. Wouldn't you then... understand that I don't get indignant unnecessarily. I have enough indignant feelings that I know to save my actual public indignance for times when it is warranted.
But it's also directly personal to you because you've held on to it for like 10 years, Jeff.
I have held on to it for 10 years.
So
that is true.
By nature, if you feel like you were wrong, regardless of whether or not it was a truthful wronging or not, it makes sense that you would hang on to it. It makes sense that you'd believe that Sam kicked off his shoes for the pure intention of winning. But
does the
I
fact
can't,
does
I can't
the but
prove
but my perspective, here's the thing. Over time, the point that you're trying to make here is that over time that it has grown? Is that the implication?
You have let this fester for 10 plus years.
But here's the point. Never once have I wavered from the moment that it happened that he did this intentionally. Not once have I gone off that fact, because it is a plain and clear fact. He is a dirty cheat. and he wants to win.
The problem is I have no evidence, Jeff. Like, if you could have shown me in the People's Court that we presented last week that in a race in the hot dog derby between you and Sam Mellinger and whoever the third guy was whose name escapes me,
it doesn't matter,
he was ketchup, it's regardless.
Okay, what if I got a character witness? What if we got the third man in the race?
I don't know, can we try him? Is there double jeopardy involved?
Listen, if you would two people's voices be enough evidence to you without the video being in place?
I would allow it, but then do I need to give Sam the opportunity to respond?
No, Sam had his chance to defend himself. He was in the seat, man. He was cross-examined and you sided with him, and that's okay. All well and good, but this is bringing in another witness. If we don't have physical evidence, then you need to trust the veracity of witnesses. And I think in this case, David Boyce would put his hand on a Bible and swear that Sam Mellinger absolutely intentionally kicked off his shoes.
And he was the third member in the race?
He was the third member. He was the third member of the race with three members.
But I don't know if I can buy in, because he also lost the race. There's pride on the line for him too.
There is.
And he's more likely to side with you because of the fact that in this war of attrition between you and Sam, you know, he's the forgotten man. He's the ketchup amongst the condiments in the race for victory.
Yeah, that he is. But
so
but that
I,
also,
I'll
here's
think
the
about
thing.
It.
I feel like he has no reason to lie at this point. His place in history is written in stone. And
okay.
And well, no, that's not quite exactly true, because he did ultimately end up finishing second. So if Sam were disqualified, he would have won.
Okay. All right. I'm willing to allow it. I'm willing to allow the third character witness into discussion here. That seems perfectly reasonable. I can hear that point of view. Before we actually get to some baseball, I was thinking about you today because I walked into the office and I realized that you have the comfort of being able to write your columns and to do your podcast from from your humble abode. And I realize that you have missed out on one of the great delights of working in an office. And there's not a lot of them, but I think arguably one of the best things about working in an office is the birthday cake that just shows up in the kitchen. And obviously doesn't show up. There's somebody nice and caring and compassionate that usually takes care of this, but the dessert surprise when you walk into the office is an absolute treat, no pun intended. And today, it's, you know, we're recording this at 10 o'clock in the morning. I walk in today, not only do I find one cake, but man, I found two cakes today. There was a chocolate chip cookie cake, which I think is an elite level of cake that not enough people speak of.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was also this flourless chocolate cake as well. Which was
wow.
Really rich and dark chocolate and was fantastic. And I'm wondering if you've ever felt like you've missed out on this type of experience being a writer for so long and working out of your own home space.
You know, when you brought this up, I was thinking to myself that you're overrating the office cake, because I always picture the office cake as one of those spongy, over-frosted, like last, you know,
like grocery,
get it at the last
cakes?
Minute grocery store cakes.
Okay.
Exactly. But the fact that you had a chocolate chip cookie cake and like a rich flourless chocolate cake makes me even more glad that I work from home. Because I would be, if I were exposed to office cake regularly, I would be fat. I would just turn into a fat person. And look, people who enjoy their cake probably enjoy their lives more than I do. And that is a perfectly reasonable decision to make and a perfectly great way to live life. My narcissism gets in the way of everything though. And I figure there's going to be some point in my life where I will allow myself to regularly enjoy the benefits of cake and maybe even office cake. But right now, man, I'm just not there. The temptation would be too much. It would overwhelm me. My productivity, if I worked in an office, would be less because of the presence of office cake.
Interesting. Yep. So to you, it's not about the opportunity to enjoy the delicious desserts that are presented for free in front of you. It's the distraction of it sitting there, knowing that if you took part in it, you would just get fat and not be able to get any work done.
That's the thing. I'm going to sit there thinking, okay, you know, how many miles do I have to run for this piece of delicious cake? And oh my God, that was so good. I'm going to have another. Like my willpower is not one of my greater qualities.
It's not a strength. Okay.
No. And so I almost feel like I'd be like White Goodman, where I just go there and like just start sniffing it, put it near my mouth, and then just put the nipple clamps on and fire away.
The White Goodman reference is fantastic, by the way. That's nice dodgeball reference.
White Goodman is fantastic. That movie is so stupid, and I watch it every single time it's on TV.
Dodgeball Shawshanks you if it's on TV?
Oh, Dodgeball is my ultimate rewatchable.
Wow.
I'm
that way with Superbad.
You know what? It's funny. I haven't seen Superbad in a long time. Dodgeball's always on though. Like the Jason Bateman character, Cotton McKnight.
Cotton McKnight was Gary Cole.
Gary Cole character. And what's the Jason Bateman?
I don't know, but it's the classic line.
I should know this.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see.
Bold strategy, Cotton. I will use bold strategy, Cotton, all the time.
I think one of the more underrated lines in that movie. First of all, one of my favorites is the White Goodman. Nobody makes me bleed my own blood.
Bleed my blood. Yeah. But Pepper Brooks, by the way.
Pepper Brooks, good pull. The scene with Vince Vaughn and Lance Armstrong at the bar is one of the funniest scenes in a movie.
Oh.
And nobody ever talks about it. You know, I was thinking about quitting once when I was diagnosed with three different forms of cancer all at the same time. But thanks to, you know, my support system and family, I got back on the bike and I won 7 straight Tour de France's. But I'm sure you have a perfectly legitimate reason to quit.
I mean, I love it when Justin Long's character gets smushed by the cheerleader and it comes back to him and he goes, "That was the worst."
By the way, I don't know if you ever get like this if you're in New York or Los Angeles, but I've been in New York 4 times in my – no, I'm sorry, 3 times in my life. Mm-hmm. Every time I've been to New York – I run into Justin Long. I see him on the street. It's the strangest thing. The first time it was outside of Madison Square Garden. The second time it was in the East Village, and then the third time I was meeting of course he works with Yahoo, Jordan Schultz. So I was meeting him when he was working at the Huffington Post, and I was walking into the Huffington Post building in New York City. Justin Long is walking out of the Huffington Post building. I was like, no, not again! And so the fourth time, if I see him the next time I'm in New York, I just have to say something, and he'll be freaked out, and he'll be completely thrown off. But I have to say something. It's fate.
The best part about Dodgeball to me is there are a bunch of like really good actors.
Yes.
In it.
The guy who played Milton from Office Space.
Oh yeah, Stephen Root is Fent. No, I don't think the guy who played Milton from Office Space. I think that's a different guy than Stephen Root. I think you're confusing him with Stephen Root.
Are you sure? I'm pretty sure it's the same guy.
It is not the same guy. Are you talking about Gordon, the guy who's got the mail order wife?
That's not the same guy?
Different guy.
No way.
Different guy.
No way. That's not Milton?
That is not Milton, I don't think.
I've been going on this for what year did Dodgeball come out in 2004?
Oh, sounds about right.
I've been going off of this for 14 years.
Wait, was it Stephen Root?
I'm pretty sure.
I
mean, we have the internet in front of us. I mean, this is really compelling podcast material.
I think you're right. Damn it.
Stephen Root, Gordon.
All right. Right, I know he's Gordon, but he was Milton?
Let's confirm this. I am 99% sure.
Either way,
of the Hill, and then wasn't like Mike Judge a part of Office Space as well?
Yeah, I think you're probably right, man. Yeah, he was Milton. Good call.
All right, I have that. But I mean, you're right. Like, think about all the other great actors in that movie.
I'll tell you who the sneaky one is. Crazy Eyes Killa.
Chris Williams.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that was a really good pull. Alan, is it Tudyk?
Tudyk,
the pirate. Gary Cole, Jason Bateman. Hank Azaria is the young Patches O'Houlihan.
Did you watch Barry on HBO?
I got through the first couple episodes and wanted to get back to it and didn't have a chance to finish it. But I heard it was fantastic.
Stephen Root is great in that show.
What I mean, is he like one of the main characters?
He's Barry. He's Barry's handler.
Oh, it's his handler. Okay. All right. I will get back into that. I don't know who Joel David Moore is. Who's Owen? Oh, I remember who Owen is. Owen was
in Avatar.
He was in Avatar. He was also in Grandma's Boy as the villain. The guy that talks in the robotic voice.
I am learning now not to test you at all when it comes to this. Because if you're pulling Grandma's Boy, holy shit, Benny.
Wait, can I get back to one last thing from the food category? I was thinking about this too because you were mentioning your lack of willpower, and you've also been to. Have you been to every major league ballpark yet? All 30?
No, I have not been to Atlanta's new one, and interestingly enough, I have not been to Safeco.
Ooh, Safeco's fun.
I know Safeco's great, and I'm not. I was supposed to go to Safeco, and I ended up just hanging out at my friend's house in Seattle that night. This was not while I was a baseball writer, by the way. This was when I was like 21.
All right. Well, let's. I mean, what's the it's toasted with sea salt?
Passing? Yes.
No, the critter that they serve at the games, that's like the most popular item, food item.
Toasted grasshoppers, right?
Toasted grasshoppers, yes, with a lime sea salt.
Yes. I would enjoy those.
I would absolutely try them, but not only does every ballpark have you know, certain food that they're known for and famous for, but I think a lot of the different press boxes do too. So if you had to choose any ballpark to go and eat at, whether it be in the stands or whether it be in the press box, do you know which one you would choose?
And I'm not a good person to ask this because I haven't gotten like a wide enough selection at places to have like a good thorough take on it.
Okay.
There's really no there's no gourmet press box dining, but you can find so much good food at stadiums these days.
Yeah.
And it's good food in the most like calorically horrible sense of the definition.
Right, but you know that going in.
Sure. Ballpark food is just like as excessive as you can get, like exponentially worse. It's like they're trying to top each other for make America fatter than it already is.
Right. It's like burgers are great, but you know what makes a burger even better? Donuts instead of the bun. Like, that's the ballpark food mindset.
I mean, that is actually true.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in St. Louis, before I started working in D.C., when I was broadcasting for the Gateway Grizzlies, that was their signature item. It was baseball's best burger at the Gateway Grizzlies game, which was a bacon cheeseburger served with a Krispy Kreme donut as the bun.
I mean, did you have it? Did you partake?
This is at a point in my life when I wasn't eating bacon, so somehow I decided to say, you know what, I'm just going to have this burger without the bacon. Like, I was, like, doing myself a favor.
I mean, it's really good.
It was really good because you had the salty and sweet perfectly combined together, and then I made the mistake of eating it before a broadcast.
Oh, that went over well,
and,
I'm sure.
Yeah, I was... I was hoping for a pitcher's duel, say that.
Instead, it went 15 innings.
Yeah, or a really, really long national anthem. Did you know that Rob Gronkowski's brother was on the Gateway Grizzlies the year I was there? His older brother, Gordy Gronkowski?
Yeah, there are a bunch of Gronks, aren't there?
Yeah, there's like five of them.
Yeah, they're very fertile.
Yeah. My buddy Josh showed up at the game and started heckling Gordy, calling him Cooper Manning.
Oh, dude. That is so mean.
I know. I told him that. And he's like, I don't know.
I feel, you know what, though? I'm like the worst person to talk with about hecklers.
Right, considering, you know, when you were on the golf course.
No. I mean, from the fact that I have some sympathy for the athletes, and I feel like Joey Votto is one of my favorites for many reasons. But the fact that he'll just go and shut a heckler up is great.
Yeah.
And it's one of those like where athletes, when they say to hecklers, "You couldn't do this," I'm actually kind of okay with that. Like under a lot of circumstances, athletes or anyone really saying you can't do what I do, so shut up.
Right.
I find to be kind of obnoxious. But in that regard, when they're coming at you for that, you gotta crack back.
I think so too. Yeah, and you have the platform, and as long as it's instigated by the fans, then then kudos to the athlete for doing it. Let's actually get into a little bit of baseball because we've seen a really compelling series. Over the last couple weeks or so, with the NL Central starting to get a little bit closer between the Brewers and the Cubs, and
I'll say a little bit closer. I mean, it's as close as you can get really without it being tied at this point.
Yeah, but I mean, the Cubs never had I think more than like a 5-game lead or so, and Milwaukee has crept back. They're 8-2 in their last 10. They went to Chicago and took 2 out of 3. Mm-hmm. And everything that I thought about Milwaukee from the idea of I knew that their offense would hold up. And I knew that the top of the lineup I really liked in Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich. I thought those were two outstanding moves by David Stearns. But I always had concerns about the pitching. And I knew their bullpen was good and Hader was elite. But their starting pitching over the last several weeks has stepped up to levels that I did not anticipate. And it's been led by Julius Chacin, who's been incredible.
Not just Julius Chacin, but Wade Miley has been ridiculous. I mean, they have just the number of guys that they have that have just stepped up, like shockingly, been good. It's amazing. At the deadline, you know, they go out and get Jonathan Scope. And it's like, okay, they get Mike Moustakas.
A lot of lineup moves as opposed to what we thought they would need.
And it's like, okay, where's the pitcher again? Like, what are you guys doing here? But, you know, their bullpen has been stabilized with Corbin Burnes coming in there, and he was a guy who I honestly assumed was going to start. Gio Gonzalez, they went out and got him from the Nationals, and he's plugging in very nicely. And not only are they pretty damn close to a guarantee to make the playoffs at this point, they may push the Cubs to a wild card game. And I mean, that boggles the mind, to be honest. It really is incredible. They've just had awesome, awesome pitching this month. And, you know, let's put it this way. When Joaquin Soria, when you're in the middle of a month, we're almost halfway through September, and when a relief pitcher has given up far and away the most runs of anybody on your team, that's pretty damn good. I mean, right. Joaquin Soria has given up 7 runs this month. Nobody else has given up more than 4.
Right. I think Brandon Kinsler has given up 7 runs in the last day for the Cubs.
Well, I was going to say.
I know, but he's been bad since he's come over, Jeff.
I feel bad. I don't know him, but I still feel bad.
Ever since you guys had that conversation.
Ever since he was my source that wasn't my source, he's really been terrible.
The passing curse is real and it's spectacular. But you were saying that them at one point passing the Cubs in the Central was almost unfathomable. And based on the talent...
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. Based on the talent, I think that's true.
Right. But, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, like if Milwaukee won the division, would we look at that truly based on the talent on Milwaukee's team as a massive upset?
Yeah. I'm not saying the Brewers aren't talented, but I think if you're looking at raw this year was like a rejoinder against raw talent, though. I'm serious.
No, I think you're right.
Dodgers are far and away the most talented team in the National League West. They're a game and a half back of the Rockies. The Nationals were the most talented team. And you can make an argument after they've dumped a bunch of guys that they still are the most talented team in the National League East. And they're done. Though it is interesting to see the Phillies are a half game ahead of the Nationals right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Phillies are 3 games above. Nationals are 2 games above, and Philadelphia's also been in a tailspin. They've lost 5 in a row.
They've absolutely collapsed at this point. It's fascinating to me too to see that the 2 wild cards are probably going to come out of the Central. And I gotta be honest, part of me is kind of rooting for a Cubs Cardinals wild card game.
It'd be fun. I mean, as speaking from a Cub fan perspective, obviously I'd rather have them win the division. But man, if you're going to have a 1-game playoff, that's fun. And
yeah,
that's great for baseball.
There is also the possibility of a Cubs Cardinals division series if the Cubs can hold on to the best record in the National League. I mean, Atlanta's creeping up. You know, mm-hmm. Atlanta's 2.5 behind for the best record in the NL right now.
Yeah, winners of 5 straight.
I was gonna say they've won 5 in a row. Acuna's a god. Freddie Freeman. I mean, they have, like, between Acuna and Freeman, like, that is two absolute star players in that lineup there. And, you know, we're not even talking about Ozzie Albies or Nick Markakis, who's, you know, continued to have a great year, or Johan Camargo has flown under the radar. I don't know if he was my breakout guy, but I drafted him in every fantasy league I had because I had a couple of scouts this offseason tell me Johan Camargo was the most improved player in winter ball this year. If they give him a chance, he's going to be really good, and he could be a Marwin Gonzalez type for them. And that's exactly what he's been. He's been absolutely fantastic. Inciarte is solid and will catch pretty much everything. Their catcher platoon with Kurt Suzuki and Tyler Flowers is really productive. Like, it's a good baseball team, man. It is a good team. And the fact that they this year alone had 3 starting pitchers in Colby Allard, Bryce Wilson, and Mike Soroka, who were up at 20 years old. The fact that they have Luis Gohara as well, Tuki Toussaint, who's 22, Ian Anderson had one of the best years, made my all minor league team, which posted today over at Yahoo Sports. Kyle Wright, another guy. Like, they are absolutely loaded with young arms. And Kevin Gausman's been fantastic. Mike Foltynewicz has been great all season long. Sean Newcomb, I know he's tailed off a little bit, but another guy. If Julio Teheran's your five, you're probably doing okay.
Yeah, like, they, how many years ago, Jeff, was Teheran considered one of the best pitching prospects in baseball?
Five, probably.
Okay, so, I mean, the talent is still there, even though he's necessarily – he hasn't necessarily found his consistency.
Yeah, you know, he – Teheran seems to be one of those guys who's just going to give you okay innings. Like, I'm – if I can get out of my fifth starter – 180 innings at a 4 ERA, I'm going to be winning a lot of division championships.
Why do you think, obviously going through it now, it's easier said than done, but I think everybody looked at Atlanta thinking they were close, but it wasn't going to be this year when the season started.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be another year. And John Coppola, who's, you know, banned from baseball now, because of the dealings that the Braves had down in Latin America and because of lies that allegedly were told to Major League Baseball about it. He, you know, he was the architect for a lot of this stuff. And he gambled on young pitching and understood the attrition rate and thought, I need as many really good young arms as I can get, because if I have 10 of them, chances are probably two of them are going to be starters, two of them are going to be relievers, and the other six, something's going to happen to them here and there. But they, you know, they've done a really good job of developing these kids, and so far, at least, keeping them healthy.
The other thing about that, too, really quick, Jeff, is that I think we've started to see more practice in organizations during the draft and in international scouting focus on position players, just because you know that the risk is going to be inherently less. Like, you saw that with the Cubs as a clear-cut example, and the Dodgers as well. But in another example, when you focus entirely on pitching, you saw the success of the Mets for a short time, but the injuries are going to come as well. Atlanta did both. Atlanta had some bad years, and they found a way to just find as much young talent on both the pitching side and to stock up arms. And they got some great pitching props and the hitting prospects along the way.
Yeah, like Acuna was, I mean, they didn't know. They signed him for $100,000.
Yeah.
Like, that just, you don't sign a guy for $100,000 with the expectation that he's going to grow into this. And Ronald Acuna is not even 100 games into his career yet, and he's already got 25 home runs. He's OPSing almost 950 as a rookie. Like, the rookie of the year race this year in the National League is unbelievable.
I mean, everybody thought Albies locked it up in the first
Albies is not a rookie.
Oh, you're right. Albies isn't a rookie. My bad. Yeah. But Acuna, and this goes back to something that you had written about and talked about earlier this week on Twitter, that a couple of scouts are looking at Acuna not just as an elite-level outfielder. There's comparisons to Trout.
Yeah.
And I think people still look at Trout as an underrated figure in baseball because we just don't appreciate it. But if you're taking somebody like Acuna and putting him at that level theoretically, like, let me phrase it to you in this way, okay? Because I still think Mike Trout, to some extent, is a surprise despite the fact that he was a first round pick, because he was still drafted 27th overall. A lot of teams passed up on him because he was from the New Jersey area. And I wonder what you would consider, which of these two guys would you consider more of a surprise if they're career trajectory continues on the path that it's currently on? Who would be a bigger surprise? Would it be Mike Trout or would it be Ronald Acuna?
It would have to be Acuna. I mean, presuming that he continues on the superstar track, that's a big assumption because he's 20 years old. But Mike Trout was at least a first round pick. You know, he was a first-round pick. The attrition rate for first round picks is far smaller than it is for kids who are in the, you know, $100,000 to $250,000 bonus range from the Dominican Republic and Venezuela. And so in that respect, I think that Acuna is the bigger surprise. Though I will say John Cobolella knew very early. I remember talking with him. God, it was probably three and a half years ago now. And we were talking about Victor Robles, and he said, Ronald Acuna is better than Victor Robles. And I was like, who is Ronald Acuna?
That's a fair response at the time.
He had begun making some noise down at the lower levels, but you had to be like on the backfields to know who he was. I want to do this comparison though. Right now, Acuna has played 95 games. He's hitting .290, on base .368, slug .575, 25 homers, 14 stolen bases. Juan Soto has played 100 games, .305, 420 on base, .534 slug, 19 homers, 2 stolen bases. It's really, really, really difficult. I probably lean ever so slightly Soto right now, because that's 50 points and on base. That's a lot.
Right, but do you think Acuna wins it because of the playoff narrative? Do you think that puts him over the top?
He's got
regardless of whether it's short or not.
He's got plenty of voters. Well, here's the thing. Let's look over the narratives. He's got that going for him. He's got the home run streak going for him. He's got the all around. He's a better outfielder than Soto is. He's got the all-around player going for him. On the other hand, Juan Soto's narrative is pretty compelling, too. He's the best 19-year-old who's ever played baseball.
Yeah.
He's putting up numbers that we haven't seen from a 19-year-old since Mel Ott. And Mel Ott's been dead for like 70 years. So, that just goes to show you we haven't seen somebody doing what Juan Soto has done in a really, really long time. By the way, Mel Ott's been dead for 60 years. My apologies, Melvin Thomas.
Hey, way to go. Way to kill Mel Ott 10 years before he deserved it.
I know. Jerk. I mean, Mel Ott was pretty awesome. I don't know if you've ever looked at Mel Ott's baseball reference page. He was a big leaguer at 17. And in small sample, mind you, but hit .383 as a 17-year-old in the major leagues. Was up for about half the season next year, and then in his age 19 season, really, really was good. I mean, .322, .397, .524, hit 18 home runs, and one of the best hitters of all time.
What about somebody like, and this isn't a Rookie of the Year story, but I do think a lot of people have missed out on the remarkable season that Trevor Story has had in Colorado.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's going to warrant him MVP consideration. I think if Javi Baez is in the conversation, then I think Trevor Story needs to be in the conversation. I know that he's led all shortstops in fantasy points this year, at least from my perspective. But still, he's been remarkable. And it hasn't just translated to only home numbers for Story, which is typically what we've seen out of Charlie Blackmon. And Nolan Arenado is always a fantastic player, but I mean, he's just absolutely destroyed left-handed pitching. I think his weighted on base is over 5. I think it's him and Giancarlo Stanton that might be the only two in baseball that have a higher WOBA against left-handed pitching. But I mean, are we looking past the type of season that Story has had, or do we look at it and say, yeah, he still has half of his games in Coors Field and he has the ability to put up these type of numbers, so maybe it isn't as impressive?
I think that's exactly what it is. I think there's just always going to be the Coors Field bias, and honestly, Ben, like, it's warranted. It just is. Trevor Story's OPS is 200 points higher in Coors Field than it is on the road. And I'm really not trying to take anything away from Trevor Story, because I'll be honest, I thought that he was one of those guys who was just going to be a good for Colorado shortstop.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Or a good because of Colorado player. He's not. He is more than that. I think he could be a dude elsewhere. The plate discipline has gotten better. I think he's got a pretty big BABIP spike on his side this year, and that's helping because he doesn't tend to be a guy who hits for a high average, and he's floating around 300 at this point. But you can't deny a guy who leads the league in doubles, has 32 home runs, has stolen 25 bases, and plays really good defense at shortstop. You also have to acknowledge, at very least, the Coors Field factor. And while I think that he should be in the MVP consideration at this point, I don't think he's the best candidate even on his own team.
You still give it to Arenado?
I still think Arenado's better, yeah. And that's, again, that's not taking anything away from Story. Arenado's slugging higher. Arenado's on bases 40 points higher. And Arenado, as good as Story is on defense, is a better fielder as well.
Who are your MVP candidates right now in both leagues?
Jacob DeGrom. Like, I know that's gonna earn me a lot of sneers from Michael Wilbon, but he has been the best player in the National League this year. He just has, and so forget just the Cy Young at this point. I think that because there is a paucity of position players, look at that alliteration, stepping forward to win that award in the NL. And look, Matt Carpenter has had a great year. And Nolan Arenado has had a great year.
You have Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich leading players in WAR this year in the National League.
Yeah. I mean, Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich both have had great years. Paul Goldschmidt's had a great year.
And think about how awful his first month was, too.
Oh, my God. Goldschmidt. Carpenter. Carpenter, yeah. Carpenter was probably even worse. I mean, these guys have all had really good years. I just think that because there's no clarity there, DeGrom has separated himself in the American League. Oh God! I mean, I'm glad I'm not vote. I have a pretty tough one myself. I have the American League Rookie of the Year, and that's going to be an interesting one because of the Ohtani fact. It's really probably going to be Ohtani versus Andujar. But you know, a guy like Joey Wendell is sort of weaseled his way into consideration. In the American League right now, I think I would lean ever so slightly Mookie Betts, but that can change very quickly and very easily. And looking past a guy who's, you know, got a 460 plus on base and plays center field, am I really doing the right thing there? I mean, I think Mike Trout certainly has every bit as good of a case, and it's just going to depend on these last 2.5 weeks.
I think I would give the edge to Betts as well. Weighted on base at 441. Only guy ahead of him is Mike Trout. Highest batting average in the American League. Terrific offensive and defensive advanced numbers over at Fangraphs, too, just to put it all into perspective. So
I don't trust those numbers very much. That's nothing against Fangraphs. I just think that the publicly available defensive metrics are not indicative of what actually is the case. And it's going to be interesting to see if JD Martinez can come close to winning a triple crown and not finish in the top five in the MVP vote.
Which would be insane.
Because right now I think you put Betts ahead of him. I think you put Trout ahead of him. I think you put Jose Ramirez ahead of him. I think you put Alex Bregman ahead of him. I think you can make a very compelling case to put Francisco Lindor ahead of him. I think some people will consider putting Matt Chapman ahead of him.
Was Matt Chapman a highly rated guy coming up, or has he just sort of turned himself into one of the better infielders in the game?
He was a very good fielding player. You know, when he was drafted, the A's took him, I believe, 25th overall. And coming out of college, he went to, I think he was a Cal State Fullerton guy, maybe. He went to college in California somewhere. And he was always known as somebody who was really good with the glove, good enough where, you know, they wondered if he could play shortstop. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's him and Arenado hand in hand for who's the best third baseman in baseball, I think that exceeded their expectation. Mm-hmm. The power was there, too. I think he's become a better hitter than people thought he was going to, because he struck out a lot in the minor leagues. I mean, his last, his last season in the minor leagues struck out 30% of the time. And I think people probably figured he was going to come up and hit like, he was going to be like a 240, like 300, 480 type hitter. And he has way, way exceeded that.
He's been really good.
Yeah,
and that, awesome. that whole Athletics offense has been unstoppable. And they were fantastic. And granted, it was against Cashner in Baltimore, who's just been an utter disaster. I still don't understand why Andrew Cashner just hasn't been a bullpen guy, which he was in Chicago, which he was drafted to be. And teams were hard set on him being a starter. At one point, he threw in the mid to upper 90s.
Andrew Cashner was pretty good last year, man. I know his peripherals weren't, but that's, you know. Sometimes it's just ERA, dude. Like that is what teams will look at. And he had a 3.4 ERA in Texas last year.
That's true. Yeah, that's hard to argue. I just think back to when I remember him being dominant as late inning guy, and thought to myself, with those type of struggles, and he's still fairly young. Like he's still in his early 30s, I believe, if not maybe 30. I'd have to double check that, but I just feel it with how badly it's gone, and maybe it's just the position of being in Baltimore on a really shitty team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that could have been a possibility. I want to end with one other thing here, because at the beginning of this podcast, I think maybe in May or June, we were talking about Seattle and Scott Service as a possible manager of the year candidate, and Jerry Dipoto as a possible executive of the year candidate. And I still look at their year, 13 games over 500 and losing arguably one of their best players for an 80 game suspension, and a rotation that had Paxton dealing with injuries and a really good closer in Edwin Diaz. And I still think to myself, they're probably going to miss the playoffs. They're now 9.5 games back of the wild card, but I have a hard time looking at this Seattle season as a wasted one, as a blown season.
And I don't.
And you think they deserve all of this?
I mean, here's the problem, Ben. They have no farm system, and when you have no farm system, you need to win now.
So everything was designed to win this year, and consequently, they didn't win this year.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
That's fair.
And here's the thing. I'm gonna pull this up. I wrote about this in 10 Degrees this week, and I'm gonna. I don't want to get the numbers wrong, so.
No, you just want to quote yourself. That's perfectly.
No. I'm not going to quote myself here. I'm going to COTS baseball contracts, and I'm going to pull up the Mariners' long-term commitments.
Okay.
Because the Mariners next season already have $125 million-plus dollars committed to, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 players. The 7 players to whom, and this includes a buyout for Denard Span. And I'm sorry, it's 8 players. The 8 players are Felix Hernandez, who has been demoted to the bullpen, Robinson Cano, who's coming off a PED suspension, Kyle Seager, who's coming off his worst season as a big leaguer, Mike Leake, who's probably a 5 at best, mm-hmm. D. Gordon, who just got into a fight with Gene Segura, who is the other one, Juan Nicasio, who has had a rough season, and Wade LeBlanc. That is the core of the Mariners right now. And I understand that they have James Paxton, who is, by the way, going to be in his third year of arbitration, is going to cost probably $8-9 million. And Alex Colome, who they may have to non-tender because he's making closer money and he's not a closer there. And they've got Erasmo Ramirez. Zanino's hitting his second year of arbitration. I mean, they've got some cash to pay out. And as good as Edwin Diaz and Mitch Haniger are, and they are both very good, that is not the core of a winning team right there. That is not a team that's going to make the playoffs in a landscape where the Yankees are about to start spending again, where the Red Sox core is much better, where the Indians are loaded and will continue to be, where the Rays are ascending. And right now, we're in the West, at least. The Astros aren't going anywhere anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And the A's, you know, I think the sustainability with the A's depends on their pitching and how some of these guys like Sean Manaea and A.J. Puck come back from their injuries.
But Manaea, there's was a report that he might miss not just the remainder of this year, but possibly they're going to
miss next year too. Yeah, with a shoulder. Yeah, it's not good. But the fact is, A's are going to the playoffs right now, and the Mariners are not.
Yeah, I think context is so important too for Seattle being in a really tough division. The Angels were once again a disappointment, but they still have Trout. They still have Ohtani. There's still a collective core that excites people. Versus, you're right, in Seattle, there's just trouble ahead. And even though they are three games worse than Cleveland, who leads their division by, let's see, how many games at this point? It's a bunch, but it's because the rest of the AL Central is complete and utter dog shit. Like, yeah. I'm trying to look at it from the perspective of if you know, Seattle is in the Central, I mean, you're having a completely different conversation, and it's the team that finally has gotten themselves back into the postseason. But you also have to understand where everything is. Texas is rebuilding. The mm-hmm. Angels at some point are going to have to do so, but they have core pieces there. Houston's
yeah,
really
that's
good.
The thing. The,
and Oakland's really good, too.
It's funny. The Angels, I don't know if Oakland's going to be able to repeat this. I don't, because they, I mean, what they've gotten from Edwin Jackson this year, what they've gotten
their
from
pitching's
going
to have
Cahill
to get better. Yeah, their pitching's going to have to get better, but their offense is good, and it's going to be, there's a lot of guys locked up long-term there.
Yeah, there are, and they're good players. I mean, they've got Chapman for a while. They've got Chris Davis for a couple more years, and they got guys coming too. Like, their farm system is I think underappreciated, and I think Franklin Barreto is a guy who's going to be a good player when they find a spot for him. They just got to find a spot for him.
Yeah, they're fun though, man. And it's taken me a while to start watching more of the A's games without having fantasy lineups attached to them, but I love them. And they hit the shit out of the ball, and they are fun. And I hope they make some noise in the postseason. It would be really fun for me. I don't know if baseball would love it. But to see the A's make a really deep run and get to the ALCS, I think would be fascinating.
I would be okay with that. I'm curious to see if they win the wild card. Like, win the first wild card. It would be really interesting to see the Yankees have to go all the way across the country.
All right, Paston, before we let you go, anything coming up on the Yahoo Sports MLB podcast? Any articles in the hopper we should be aware of?
Lots of good content on the way. Nothing I want to reveal quite yet, but I promise if you check the podcast, we are going to have a good interview this week. I'm excited for that.
It's been a great show all year, but obviously, you know, it can't hold up to the Fantasy Sports Markets podcast. That goes without saying.
But what does, Ben?
That's true. That's true. And I mean, when you bring in guests like Sam Mellinger, I mean, I don't know how you compete.
Fuck that guy.
See you, Jeff.
See you, buddy.